Does the word Trojan have a welcome ring to it? Would you love to attend law school as a Trojan? Well, you've come to the right podcast because today's guest is the Associate Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid at USC Gould School of Law.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Thanks for joining me for the 573rd episode of Admission Straight Talk. Are you applying to law school this cycle? Are you planning ahead to apply to law school next year or later? Are you competitive at your target programs? Well, Accepted's Law School Admissions Quiz can give you a quick reality check. Just go to accepted.com/law-quiz, complete the quiz, and you'll not only get an assessment, but tips on how you can improve your chances of acceptance. Plus, it's all free. Again, take this short quiz at accepted.com/law-quiz to obtain your free assessment. Now for today's interview. I'm delighted to have back on Admission Straight Talk, David Kirshner, Associate Dean of Admissions, Financial Aid, and Innovation at USC Gould School of Law. Dean Kirshner earned his undergraduate degree at USC in Political Science and Film Production. He then earned his JD at California Western School of Law. He's been in law school admissions since 2006, when he joined Loyola Law as an Associate Director of Admissions. In 2011, he became Director of Admissions at USC Gould, and in 2016, he became USC Gould's Associate Dean and Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid. Dean Kirshner, thanks for joining me again on Admissions Trade Talk. Welcome back.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Linda.
Wonderful. Now, I always like to start with this question because some people may not have listened to the previous episode. So can you give us an overview of the more distinctive elements of USC Gould's JD program?
Yeah, certainly. So I think one of the things that really sets our JD program apart is the fact that it's relatively small in class size, and that allows us to offer a very student-centered approach to the program. I like to tell prospective students, admitted students, and enrolled students that they're not merely passers-by during their 3 years in the JD program, but that they're owners of their legal education. And I think our small size and our student-centered approach really do allow us to give students the opportunity to take ownership of their legal education.
Okay, great. And how does that ownership manifest itself? Does it mean they have, there's more flexibility in the program? They have more opportunity to shape the program that they engage in?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's both of those things. From a curricular standpoint, once a student gets beyond the first year required courses, in the second and third year, we have very few requirements. It's a handful. There's an upper division writing requirement. There is a required class on race, racism, and the law. That's a new addition since we last talked, and that's something we're very proud of that's now part of our curriculum, right? So there's that upper division writing requirement. There's the race, racism, and the law course. And then there's an experiential learning requirement. So we want to ensure that our students have some kind of practical experience before they graduate. Beyond those three requirements, it's really up to the student to shape those second and third years in a way that they believe will most benefit them.
Right. And indeed, the USC Gould website emphasizes the flexibility of the curriculum, specifically in the second, third years, and the experiential learning opportunities. Can you, you've touched already on the flexibility. Can you touch on the experiential learning opportunities? Because I know they're quite broad, really.
Yeah, no, they are. And I think we look at experiential learning as a really broad umbrella. So there are clinical programs, which are certainly a major part of our experiential learning opportunities. So for listeners who may not know the difference between a clinical program and an externship, a clinical program is housed within the law school and is led by full-time clinical faculty at the law school. Six of our seven clinics serve live clients, and we think it's really important that students gain that experience serving live clients via our clinical programs. Then there's the externship program. So that's where we send students off campus to get experience in a wide variety of legal settings. Being in Los Angeles gives us so much opportunity to tap into a very diverse legal market, right? So whether it's a traditional judicial externship, where a student may spend a semester, and most of ours are with federal judges in the central district. They get incredible experience in a courtroom and in a judge's chambers, or taking advantage of our location in the heart of the media entertainment capital, really of the world. We have students working at movie studios, talent agencies, record labels, and streamers. So tremendous opportunities for students to get that hands-on practical experience. So those are probably the two largest aspects of our experiential learning offerings, the clinical programs and the externship opportunities.
If somebody signs up for a clinic or an externship, is that a semester commitment? Is that a year-long commitment? Is it a two-year commitment?
Yeah, so externships tend to be semester-long commitments.
Okay.
Our clinical programs tend to be year-long. But for example, the mediation clinic, if a student does that in their 2L year and really enjoys it, they can then come back their 3L year and do what we call our advanced mediation clinic, where the level of case that they're able to oversee in the LA Superior Court. So these mediation students are actually working in the Superior Court.
Wow.
It goes from small claims in the first year of the clinic to potentially unlimited civil disputes in the second year of the clinic.
Yeah, people can get pretty heated in those things.
Yeah.
So, and one question that occurred to me as you were speaking, you said that most of the clinics are live cases. What is the clinic that's not a live case? And does that mean they're looking at a historical fact, or what would what would be a non-live?
Yeah, it's a great question. So for us, the non-live client is our international human rights clinic.
Okay.
That clinic is focused on more policy level issues. I mean, the reason that it's not live client, I think, is a wonderful reason. So students in the international human rights clinic are working most of the time directly for judges on international tribunals or at The Hague. So those students get to spend time abroad more often than not. And rather than serving an individual client, say with a landlord-tenant dispute, they're working on prosecuting some of the worst war crimes offenders and other international and transnational issues that rise to the level of an international tribunal like The Hague.
Okay. All right, that answered the question, but it was what's non-live, but okay, that answered the question. Now, last time you were on, we discussed media entertainment law and the clinic that's associated with it. And I'm going to link to that interview from the show notes. But Southern California is home both to Silicon Valley, or California, I should say, is home to Silicon Valley and Silicon Beach. Silicon Beach is in Southern California. Yeah. Can you dive into the intellectual property and technology law clinic? Give us a little bit more information on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's one of our wonderful clinical opportunities. And students in the, we call it our IP and tech clinic, they get to handle a variety of issues that are largely shaped by our location. That clinic in particular works very closely with the USC School of Cinematic Arts. And we are fortunate in that, you know, we're a law school on the campus, with which what has arguably the best film school in the world. I may be a little biased considering my undergraduate major happens to be from there, but there certainly is truth to it. So our law students get to work with undergrad and or graduate filmmakers on issues like fair use in documentary films, right? So can this music clip be used for a certain amount of time in this project? And does the distribution of the project have any impact on the outcome to that question? So it's questions like that with very practical applications. Within our School of Cinematic Arts is also a video game. They have a very strong video game development program. And so our IP and tech clinic students also work extensively with those video game students on a lot of the same questions. What content can fairly be used or adapted in a video game? Is it in the public domain? Is there fair use doctrine that allows its usage? So not only are they getting to work on substantive questions like this, but they're also getting to interact with individuals who may be their future clients in practice. You know, and I think that's one of the benefits of being at a law school. And it's not just at USC, but being at any law school that's part of a larger university that has a great constellation of other graduate programs on campus. The IP and tech clinic also, you know, certainly apart from the traditional media and entertainment, to the extent that there are students with STEM and tech backgrounds in the clinic in any given year, they can also handle more technical cases. The head of our clinic, Professor Jeff Perlman, has an outstanding background in tech, both on the academic side as in the real world. So if we have students coming in with a tech background who maybe have already taken and passed the patent bar, the clinic can also handle some more technical kinds of cases as part of their routine curriculum.
Right. I think you're also highlighting something else, and that is that the location of a law school is relevant to the choice. There are, the resources that the school has, both within the school and in the larger university, but also location. Because if you do an externship, you're not just working with potential clients, you're also working with potential employers.
I think you're right. And I think that also that relates back to that first question that you had asked me, about anything in particular that does set Gould apart. And I think, I had talked about small size, but the corollary to that is that we're a small law school that sits in the heart of a major research university, a tier one research university, that sits in the heart of a major metropolis with one of the largest legal markets in the world. And then that metropolis sits in the heart of the Pacific Rim. So I think of it as these concentric circles, with the law school being at the very center of these three concentric circles that offer so much opportunity.
Great point. Let's turn to the application, since you've done such a good job of enticing the listener to apply. Let's turn to the application itself. USC Gould accepts both the LSAT and the GRE. Do you have any preference one over the other? Are you finding that both tools are equally predictive of future success in law school?
Yeah, so I would say we certainly don't have a strong preference for one over the other, because they have both satisfied, the fairly rigorous statistical validity studies that go into student success. The reason we accept the GRE is because we did an extensive study prior to beginning to accept it to ensure that it had some validity for our students. Now, I still think for most applicants, the LSAT's probably the preferred test, for a couple of reasons. If you want me to get into them, I briefly can. I mean, number one, even though a lot of law schools take the GRE now, a lot don't. So if you want to take one test that's going to be most widely applicable, that's going to be the LSAT. That still is, the gold standard test for law school admission purposes. The LSAT also doesn't have math on it. So for people who are not mathematically inclined, it may be a better bet, because the GRE does have a section with some, at least for me, who was never a math person, I would certainly find challenging. And moving forward, and I'm sure you know this and may have broached it on prior podcasts, the LSAT is no longer going to include the analytical reasoning section starting in August. And that would be the closest to math, although not really, that was ever on the LSAT. So, but again, I mean, largely because the LSAT is still accepted by every law school, I do think, in a cost-benefit analysis, applicants may be getting the best bang for their buck with the LSAT, but we certainly have no issues with the GRE for applicants who have taken that. I think the other thing, again, that leads kind of the LSAT to be the gold standard is, without getting too much into the weeds on this, when we report to our accreditors every year, the American Bar Association, their instructions are, if someone's taken both the LSAT and the GRE, you only report the LSAT score. Right. So for all intents. Yeah. Yeah. So for all intents and purposes, if someone's taken both, they're an LSAT only taker for the purposes of our accreditors.
Got it. Interesting. Okay. Now, how do you view multiple test scores? And I don't mean so much, the LSAT and the GRE. I mean, multiple LSAT scores or multiple GRE scores.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the norm now. Seeing multiple scores is the norm. So I've been working in the business long enough to remember, when our accreditors, the ABA, would tell us, well, you have to report the average score, right? If you have a test taker who's taken multiple tests, we want the average.
Right.
It's been about a decade that they now, right, say, well, give us the high score, right? So that alone made taking the test multiple times a much more palatable solution for an applicant. So my only caveat now is, if you take a test multiple times, and you have a score differential that's beyond the standard deviation, right? So a significant differential on the LSAT, that's plus or minus 3 points, that you include a short addendum and you know, kind of let us know what happened.
Yeah.
And you know, in that case, there's really no harm to taking the test multiple times. But I would say, you know, I strongly recommend not taking it cold just to take it
Oh, yeah.
right on the first time, because it's time and money. You can take practice tests cold,
Yeah.
but don't take the real thing cold.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And they're free. You can get a,
Right.
yeah. All right. Is there, have you given any thought to JD Next?
Yeah, I mean, we have given, you know, we have certainly given thought to JD Next, and I'm in favor of, you know, creative solutions, whatever they may be, to widening the top of the funnel, right? To get more and more people into the law school application pipeline. You know, the ABA had some independent consultants look at JD Next, and you know, they issued a report that had some positive and some negative things to say about JD Next. So my big concern is that any tool that's to be used as part of our admission process has a strong set of predictive validity behind that. Right now, we're convinced that the LSAT and GRE do. We're not convinced about any other products on the market right now. But I know JD Next is one that they're continuing to work on. And I know LSAC has a platform called Law Ready that they're working on. So as more new products hit the market, I only think that can be helpful.
Great.
Is yeah.
I found the concept of JD Next just really intriguing. In other words, the idea that, well, let's give people the skills that prepare them for law school, and if they pass the test showing that they have the skills, they're ready. You know, and again, I'm not, again, that's the concept behind it as I understand it. And just it sounded like it would A, open more doors, and it should be valid. You know, if it's not, then it doesn't live up to its promise or the concept. But
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, statistical validity, it's a tough hurdle to overcome. And I'm, you know, and I would presume and be certain that, you know, the folks over at JD Next, after reading the,
working
yeah, after reading the independent consultant's report, will be looking at some of what has said as they go on and iterate and reiterate their, right.
right. What about the experiential, not requirements, but desired qualities? Let's put it that way. Okay. What kind of experience, either during college or full time after college, is good preparation for USC Gould?
Yeah, I mean, so if I boil it down to one word, it would be engagement. We're looking for individuals who have been engaged in whatever communities they've been a part of. So it could be their college community, it could be volunteering in their home community or in their college community. It could be individuals who have worked to help support themselves through college. It could be their work community. For people with gap years, it is their employment community. For us, engagement is so important, again, because we're small, you know, and with a first year class of fewer than 200 people, I want to make sure that everyone in the first year class is prepared to make an impact on our law school community. So engagement is crucial to making someone a well-rounded applicant. Just, you know, seeing that they're really more than a collection of great grades and test scores, and engagement goes to that.
All right. Well, that actually leads to my next question. And I might have mentioned to this to you the last time you were on, but if you'll indulge me, let me repeat this story. Way back in 1996, I attended a local conference of pre-law advisors. At the first session I attended, a dean of a local law school argued very forcefully that all those people who only look at the GPA and LSAT are wrong, that in admissions, they really look at it much more, application much more broadly. And he received an enthusiastic round of applause to his comments from the advisors there. The next session was pre-law advisors only. And all they talked about was the LSAT and the GPA. So I was sitting there listening. And I was thinking, there's a little bit of a disconnect here. Now, today is obviously the GRE. And I do believe that over the last almost 30 years, admissions has become more holistic. But what factors, in addition to engagement that you just mentioned, if any, do you weigh in addition to the test score and GPA?
Yeah, I think I mean, even to test score and GPA, there's context to it. So the
Sure.
contextual factors are really important, especially with with GPA, and I tend to think of it more as an academic record, right? I look at the full picture of someone's academic record. Was there an upward trend or a downward trend? Was there a change of majors? Did someone start at community college and transfer to a four-year to receive their degree? And how was that transition from community college to the four-year? Was the applicant working while in school, and how many hours a week were they working? Were there family obligations? So, right. So number one, it's about digging deeper than just the number itself, especially on the grade point average, you know, but beyond the numeric factors, it really is a holistic process. I mean, you know, I tell prospective students all the time, do the numbers matter? Yes, the numbers matter. I would not be truthful if I had said the numbers don't matter. But going back to my film background, you know, I think of the numbers frame how the rest of the application is viewed, right? It tells me what I need to be focusing on as I'm looking through that lens and reviewing the application. So there are the numeric factors. There's the context behind the numeric factors. And then there are all of the intangible qualities that make a strong applicant. For me, the personal statement is a really crucial part of an application, not just to assess the substance of why someone wants to go to law school, but also the stylistic choices, you know, and ensuring that grammatically it's a well-written, mistake-free, it's a writing sample. At the end of the day, it's a writing sample. So I find the written pieces really important. The letters of recommendation are another important aspect, because with letters of rec, in particular academic letters of rec, I'm not having to substitute my judgment. I'm getting to read what someone who has seen this person in a classroom has to say about them, right? Whether it's a professor or a teaching assistant, I'm getting to see firsthand the words from someone who's observed this individual in an academic setting. So all of those pieces are really important, but the numbers are the framing mechanism by which I assess the rest of the application.
You know, I'm wondering, as I'm listening to you, is it the numbers are the framing mechanism, or is the context framing the numbers?
You know what? They do both. Right? Because the numbers, when I see the numbers, I get this series of questions in my head, right? Like immediately when I see the numbers, I'm going to start asking myself some things. And if the application is well done, it's going to answer those questions for me. Right. And so we may have talked about
what are
about
some
this,
of those questions?
Yeah. And I think we may have talked about this on the first podcast, but I think one of the most important things an applicant can do is be self-reflexive going into the process. I think one thing law schools do well is we put a lot of information out there. We put a lot of really accurate information out there. Here are our medians. Here are our 25th percentiles. Here are our 75th percentiles. An applicant should know that going into every school that they apply to, right? What the law school's profile looks like and what their profile looks like. And, you know, take what, you know, kind of the social media universe likes to call splitters. Someone who has a standardized test score that may be up here, right? And a grade point average that might be down here, or vice versa. Well, I'm going to be asking what's more predictive, right? So if you're an applicant with a grade point average, you know, that's straight A's and an LSAT score that may be below our median or below our 25th percentile, part of your job is to make the case and to make the convincing case that that grade point average is more indicative of the kind of law student you're going to be. So that's the type of question, you know, I'm going to be asking as I'm looking at an application.
That makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Now, you touched on the personal statement a minute ago and its importance. The Gould website asks for a 2 to 3 page personal statement. And the site says, we are particularly interested in how your background, academic or otherwise, has led to your decision to study law. This is not the place to repeat items on your resume. What are the, obviously, don't just repeat items on your resume, but what are the ingredients of a good response? What would you like to see in there? I'm going to guess that self-reflection is going to play a role.
It absolutely does. And we're purposely very open-ended on it because I think that's the more difficult personal statement to write. At the end of the day, I think a really good personal statement answers the why question, right? Why law school and why now? Law school is a significant investment in both time and money. So it's a big investment in resources. And over the years, in particular at Gould, I've seen very, very, very few students not succeed. And the common thread between the students who haven't been successful is they can't answer the why question. So for me, it's really important to have a strong sense of who you are and how who you are has influenced this desire to attend law school now. A trap that people fall into in personal statements fairly often is a lot of times, and I completely understand this, we have influences in our lives, be it siblings, close friends, family members, and that may be responsible for someone's decision to go to law school. But at the end of the day, the personal statement needs to be about the applicant, not about their sibling, not about their parent. It's certainly okay to talk about how someone may have influenced you, but I really need to know why you want to go to law school, because I'm admitting you. At the end of the day, I'm admitting you, the applicant, not your parent or your sibling. So, and like you said, self-reflection is a huge part of that, but it's an important part of a quality personal statement.
Right, absolutely. And every so often, I've read personal statements where the applicant talks one third or one half the essay
Yeah.
about a particular influencer, whether it's a parent or a grandparent. And it's very nice, but
Yep,
doesn't tell you
yep.
anything about
Well,
them.
and I think, right, that the why being so important, and I know I think you were going to touch on AI and our policy on AI,
Right,
the
we're going to get
why
there.
being so important,
Yeah.
at least right now, is a big reason why we don't allow AI to be used on any of the written materials in the application.
Right. And you're actually really clear about it in your website that you do not want applicants to use ChatGPT or AI in writing their essays. I'm convinced that you're on a campus with an engineering school and all the tech that USC has. I'm convinced AI is going to become more pervasive. Do you think your policy might change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be foolish for me to say it's never going to change, right?
Right.
Because that's ignoring the pace at which technology changes.
Yeah.
So I certainly think we're open to seeing where things go. But for now, and I've certainly spent time in ChatGPT and other AI tools, as well as talking to faculty members who are very knowledgeable about it. AI cannot write a personal statement with the level of depth that we want to see
Okay, that's
in
pretty
an
clear.
applicant's personal statement.
Yeah, well, that's very, very clear. Let's go back to the other writing samples or writing pieces on the application, specifically the diversity of background essay and or your the experience statement. I'm guessing it should complement and not duplicate the personal statement. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. Yes.
If let's say somebody answers the why question and does a good personal statement, what I mean the why is related to their background, their personal background. So then what would go into the I mean, how should applicants parse these two things out is basically
Yeah,
where I'm
no,
going with all that.
it's a great question, and there's a fine line between being complimentary and repetitive, right? So I think with the personal statement focused on the why, right? I kind of view that kind of like as the intrinsic motivation that's driving someone to law, whereas the statement of background and experience, and again, this is all just kind of these are all guidelines and suggestions.
Of
There's
course.
nothing saying this is the only way. But I think the statement of background and/or experience, by its nature, is where an applicant can discuss some of the more external factors that have kind of make them different from the rest of the applicant pool. So I think, right, whereas the personal statement is intrinsic in looking inwards about personal motivation, the statement of background and/or experience is an applicant's opportunity to talk about what makes them think they're different from the rest of the applicant pool, or what unique experiences that they have gone through in their lives, have them prepared for law school. And it's things like, I've seen great background and experience statements about being a collegiate athlete and how that's prepared someone. Or growing up in a foreign country, speaking a different language, how that has prepared someone. And so I think one of the things we've done, so we really overhauled this statement over the past cycle. Certainly, the Supreme Court decision had a lot to do with us overhauling it, but I actually think I've seen much improved statements this year versus when we called it a generic diversity statement. you probably see we now have six different subprompts that someone can choose to write about with the statement of background and experience. And I think I've seen much more well-written, highly targeted statements of background and experience this cycle.
I wonder if you're also learning more about the individuals because they maybe feel they can talk about, I don't know, you mentioned being a collegiate athlete, maybe being a skier or being of a particular religion or, you know, whatever makes them them.
Yeah, I think so. I think we've gotten
it can
more.
Be about diversity in the more traditional senses of the word, but it can be something very, you know, different from that also.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this new prompt has helped us get at that a lot better.
Okay. Does Gould School of Law consider update letters from applicants who have something significant to tell you after they submit their applications and before hearing back from you? Or is it like deadline?
No, we do. We welcome updates. You know, the tricky part is what's significant.
Yes, I know.
Right. I mean, you know, for us in particular, we get a lot of people asking if they can update their resume. Certainly if there's a new job, you know, or many of our applicants are on the verge of graduating from college, if there's a significant academic award leading into commencement. We welcome those updates, but they do have to be material for us to make them a formal part of the application.
All right. Do you have any plans to introduce either in-person interviews, either Zoom interviews or physical interviews, or a video component to the application?
We don't, not in the immediate future.
Okay.
We don't. We previously had conducted video interviews. I think we were probably a little bit ahead of the curve in conducting waitlist video interviews over 10 years ago.
Really? Wow. Before COVID.
Yeah. Oh, well before. Yes. Yes. Well before, you know, and for a variety of reasons, we discontinued that, and moving forward, at least in the immediate future, I don't see us going back to interviews.
All right. Do you have any advice for waitlisted applicants? Since I suspect at this time of year, we probably have a few of them hanging out.
Yeah. Just a few, right? Yeah.
Just a few, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, key is for waitlisted applicants is patience. The longer a waitlisted applicant can be patient, I think has a direct correlation to the probability of them hearing a positive outcome, right? Because the key, you know, to the waiting list is what we do or don't do is predicated on what people who have already been admitted do. And that changes throughout the summer. So it's be patient, stay tuned to your inboxes and look for emails from us. Law schools often, before extending offers from a waiting list, we'll put kind of what we call feeler emails out there. We'll ask people if they remain interested and willing to commit. So if you get one of those, you want to respond quickly, but you also want to respond honestly. You know, I make it no secret when I'm talking to waitlisted candidates, our goal is to extend as few offers as possible off the waiting list if we need to extend any. And so that's going to go to candidates who are genuine in saying, yes, I'm still interested and still willing and still able to attend. You know, it's pay attention to your email. And certainly periodic letters of continued interest are welcome from waitlisted candidates, because that's another way beyond when we reach out, that's a way to proactively continue to let us know that you're interested. And I certainly think, like, at this point forward, there's nothing wrong with once a month sending a letter of continued interest to us.
That's great. Thank you. Great advice. And I assume that the waitlist, the letters of continuing interest, could also update you as to, again, new honors, new jobs, new activities, new whatever, responsibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. But, absolutely.
All right. Do you have any advice for transfer applicants to USC?
Yeah, the transfer process in many ways, I think, is a more straightforward process than, you know, the first year application process. You know, for first year applicants, we ask for all of this information because we're trying to make an educated guess as to first year performance, right? I mean, that's really what applications are doing, is applications are trying to assess how successful someone can be in the first year of law school, right? Not if they're going to pass the bar, not how good an attorney they'll make, really just that they can get through the first year. With transfer students, we have that information. We have the first year transcript from a transfer student. So
the first semester. You may not have the whole first year, right?
Well, so for our early transfer program,
we
have the first semester, but for our regular decision transfer program, we don't complete those applicants until we have the full first year grades.
Got it.
So for a good portion of our transfer pool, will have the full first year grades. Even first semester grades, though, are helpful. And right, because we see how the student's done. So, you know, my advice would be do as well as you possibly can do in the first year of law school. There is no substitute for grades as a transfer student. And then the second piece is be able to articulate a reason for why you want to transfer beyond just like the proverbial trading up, right? So, you know, because a transfer student who gets into Gould will have done very well in their first year. So they'll be giving up some things, right? Their law school may let them grade onto law review. They may have a seat on the moot court honors program already. So I also want to know why a transfer student is willing to give up some of those things that come with doing so well in the first year.
Got it. About how many transfer students does USC Gould accept?
Yeah, so we are normally looking to enroll anywhere between 10 to 15 transfer students. You know, to get there, we're accepting certainly marginally more than that, but the goal is about 10 to 15 transfer students.
Okay, great. Now, I noticed that innovation was added to your title since we last spoke. What innovations do you have planned for the upcoming application cycle?
Yeah,
and,
it's very.
And what innovations are you in charge of? Forget it. I mean, just the application cycle, but I assume it has to do with admissions.
Yeah, it's certainly very observant. no, so it's admissions, but I'm also working on a number of projects that are just trying to bring innovation to a wide variety of student-facing technology at the law school in general. So beyond admissions, I think one of the reasons I've been tasked with doing this is I've been successful in bringing about innovation on the admissions side of things. So one thing we've launched in the past 6 months that I'm really pleased with is we now have, we were talking about AI a little earlier, we have an AI-powered chat bot on our website. So you may have seen the little pop-up on our website.
I think I did, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a way, I mean, it's done a few things for us. It's cut down on phone calls seeking very basic pieces of information. But from kind of the tech side of things, you know, and I think people are fully aware of this, anytime you interact with a website, it's giving a company, whether it be a law school or, you know, the retail, whatever, we're getting information on that person so that we can then offer a more highly tailored set of marketing materials. So we've really, at least on the admissions side, has developed some really sophisticated marketing campaigns that are tailored to individual interests. And the chatbot, the AI-powered chatbot, is one other way that we've been able to do that. But no, kind of more on the law school wide, it's doing things to try and streamline the process from when a student first applies until they graduate, to put all of the resources in a single, easily accessible location, to just kind of make doing day-to-day things easier.
Okay, sounds good. And, you know, there was one group of applicants I didn't ask about. I meant to ask about it just a second ago. And that is, do you have advice for re-applicants? So they've applied, whether they were waitlisted or not, they are not accepted, and they want to reapply.
Yeah, it's to show growth. I think, you know, a re-applicant, they need to, again, getting back to self-reflection, is assess to the best that they can why the decision may not have gone their way, and then address that in a reapplication and show growth.
Sounds so simple.
Right. I mean, I think one of the least effective things a reapplicant can do is submit a verbatim personal statement. To me, that shows a lack of effort. It shows a lack of sincerity. And certainly, I would think there's something someone has done over the course of a year. And a personal statement should reflect that, and a resume should be updated. So, you know, it's taking some effort to show growth from the prior year.
Wonderful answer. Thank you. I sometimes give that advice and people don't like to hear it.
Well.
You know,
Well,
very unhappy with me when I tell them, do not submit the same personal statement that didn't work last year.
Well, right. Because I think sometimes, and I hear this too, it's like, oh, well, maybe the pool will be a little easier next year, so I can submit the same thing and have a different outcome. And my response to that is, right, why rely on external factors like the pool and not knowing what a pool is going to do, when with a little time and effort, you can take matters into your own hands and, right, improve your application, and the pool is going to be what the pool is going to be.
Well, I usually hear something like, oh, it was my LSAT score, it was my GPA, and I raised it, so my personal statement was really very good.
Oh,
you know, that's what I usually hear. Yeah. And I say, well, yeah, but you're not going to be showing any growth if you submit the same personal statement.
Right. That's right.
And then, well, yeah, but you know, anyways, that's my problem. I had my head bitten off for that one a few times. Anyways, it's still attached somehow. Gould's priority deadline was February 1st this year, and its regular application deadline was April 1st. Are they staying the same next year? And what advice do you have for those planning ahead? We are speaking now. It's the middle of April. Yep. This episode is going to air, I think, the very end of April or May, in May. It's springtime. What should they be doing now if they want to apply? And when should they plan to submit?
Yeah, so our deadlines will remain the same next year with the priority deadline of February 1st. Apply early. I mean, really apply early. I think most of your listeners probably have heard the term rolling admission. And what that simply means is we start making admission decisions as early, you know, November, December of the year that the cycle opens. And we continue until we hit our targets. And, you know, when we hit our targets varies, but many years it's earlier rather than later. So the earlier you apply, simply kind of by the whole supply and demand principle, there are more seats earlier in the process. So we have more flexibility in extending offers early in the process. So certainly an applicant wants to apply by our priority deadline. But in all honesty, if that application can be submitted before the new year, right, before the clock ticks midnight on New Year's Eve, even better. What should an applicant be doing now? I think, an applicant should be working out their timeline right about now. So applications at many law schools, and we're one of them, they open September 1st. So I think, right, like that goal should be to get the application in as early as possible. So that means studying for the LSAT right now, having registered or registering very soon for an LSAT administration, making sure you register for an LSAT, that if something goes wrong on test day, you have an opportunity to take another one and still get that application in a timely manner. It means starting to reach out to potential recommenders. So, right, you don't want to go to a recommender September 1st and tell them, hey, I want to submit my application next week. Give me a letter of recommendation, right? Start talking to potential recommenders now. It's time to start getting the ducks in a row so that when fall rolls around, as an applicant, you're well positioned to submit early.
Great advice. You also don't want to go to a recommender and find out they're going on a month-long vacation.
There you go.
All right. What would you have liked me to ask you? It's been a fantastic interview. Thank you.
Oh, thank
what
you.
What would you have liked me to ask you?
You know, I love getting asked, what's my favorite thing about working at Gould?
Okay. What's your favorite thing about working at Gould?
Sure. So, number one, you know, USC is my alma mater, and not everyone has the opportunity, you know, to work at a place that has played such a significant role in their lives. And I'm grateful for that. But beyond that, it's the community, you know, USC and the law school in particular. You know, we call ourselves the Trojan family. And I know that can like maybe sound kind of hokey and, you know, but it really is. It's more than an alumni network. It's a family. So we just had our big admitted students day last Friday. And I put out this blanket invitation to alums, to current students, to faculty. And I don't know why I'm amazed every year, because I should just come to expect it. But the response is just extraordinary, from managing partners at AmLaw 100 firms to close to 100 current students coming out because they just want to share their experience. And they want to be a part of helping to enroll the next generation of Gould alumni. So it's working at a place where that's the experience every day. People who truly want to be there, and people who want to make sure that the generations who come after them are just as poised for success as they are, or as they were.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that. It was a nice note to end on. So Dean Kirshner, I think we're almost out of time. You've been very generous with your time and your insights. It's really been a wonderful interview. Thank you so much for joining me and sharing your expertise. Where can listeners learn more about USC Gould School of Law?
Sure. So a great resource is our website, which is gould.usc.edu. Another great place, especially to get a little bit more of a day in the life, we have our own Gould Admissions Instagram account, and that's at USC Gould Admissions. So very simple. So strongly recommend your listeners to check out either of those venues to learn more.
Okay, great. We're going to include links to the show notes at accepted.com/573 to the USC Gould School of Law website, as well as to the Instagram account that you just gave me the URL for. So I'll include that too. And other resources that may be helpful to you listeners. Quick reminder, don't miss the law school admissions quiz. Find out if you're really ready to apply and competitive at your target schools. Take the quiz at accepted.com/law-quiz today. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.